The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make the show possible and check out the rewards for backers. Hello and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. Love is in the air this week with my guest Philip William Stover, writer of numerous romance novels, both gay and straight. Growing up, he hid his love of romance, tearing the covers off of books so nobody would notice what he was reading. But as he grew up, he started to realize the extent to which queer people are often denied an opportunity to see loving relationships depicted in media. So he made it his mission to fix that. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that The Sewers of Paris is on Twitter and Facebook, where I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode. And I hope you'll join me for our next fun-friendly live stream on September 19th at 11 a.m. Pacific. It's a nice, relaxing time to just hang out and chat. There's a link at the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. And don't forget to check out my other shows. Culture Cruise on YouTube is a deep dive into queer entertainment milestones. And check out Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends, two narrative comedy shows with drag heroes going on adventures in a world of fantasy. And a quick note, the audio on my side of this interview is a bit muffled at just the start of our conversation. But fortunately, I don't talk too much, and then it improves after a minute or two. Now, here's Philip. Well, this week I'm speaking with Philip William Stover. He's the launch author for Harlequin's new Carina Adores line of LGBTQ romance novels. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
So I grew up as a reader, and while I liked comic books and I wasn't as interested in swashbuckling pirates or whatever was offered for boys at that age, I grew up reading and loving romance. And the books that really had a strong impact on me came out in the late 80s, early 90s. They were called Silhouette First Love, and they were aimed specifically at teens, and they were strict category romances, everything you could imagine being in a romance. And I grew up devouring them, and I had this entire elaborate ritual for purchasing them and getting them into my life.
What was, like, in those books, what was speaking to you about them?
I loved the relationships between the man and the boy and the girl in these books, and I often wondered, like, did I have a connection to the boy, or did I have a connection to the girl who was liked by the boy? And I wasn't really sure, but I loved this idea of finding love. And as a young gay kid, it was science fiction to me, quite honestly. Like, I didn't think that was necessarily in my future. So these books were this way of experiencing it in ways that I couldn't. And I was reading these at like 12 and adolescence, and the idea of having romance at the school dance wasn't really in the cards for me. So these books were a way, I think, of substituting that. I specifically loved, so romance has tropes, and there are stories that go through all of the romances, like Opposites Attract or Fake Boyfriend or Fish Out of Water, Friends to Enemies. These are all of the tropes that get repeated over and over again in romance. I, of course, loved Fish Out of Water, and I loved when they were put in a new location. And also, romance leans really heavily into scene and setting. So they often have, you know, sunny California beaches or European vacation destinations. And I loved all of the escape fantasy about all of it.
Yeah. Like, tell me about, like, where you were growing up and like what the attitude was towards the kind of books that you were reading.
Terrible. So I grew up in New Jersey, as you probably can figure out within a second of talking to me. And the romance books, like, I was teased terribly for reading them. So I started doing this ritual of I'd go to the bookstore, and the first thing I would do is find a couple of books in the young adult romance that I wanted. And I would quickly flip them over so I could read the back covers. But then I would stand back and pretend I wasn't reading the back covers. And then I would, like, pick the one I wanted, and I would hope that it didn't have, like, too girly of a cover. And I would go to buy it, And I would always do this thing where I would say to the bookstore owner, now it's just me and the bookstore owner, there's no one else there. And I'd say something like, I think these are the books my sister wanted.
Uh-huh.
And he'd be like, oh, right, sure. And I would buy the books. I would get outside the store. There was an alley around the bookstore. And I would rip the covers off. And that way I felt like they were safe to read. And I wouldn't get teased for reading them. No one knew what I was reading. But it was something that I was definitely very embarrassed of back then. And really tried to hide.
So you were reading these sort of bare, coverless novels, right? But you thought, like, well, as long as nobody can see, like, the incredibly incriminating cover, I'm probably fine.
Yes, I was going to assume people were going to assume I was reading Tom Sawyer. At one point, I had sewn a fabric book cover to put over the covers that kind of hid them from people. You know, I had spent so much of my experience feeling exposed. And, you know, romances were a part of that. And I had struggled so much with, you know, being teased for being girly or all of those things. And I always thought it was something that I could control or something that I could hide in some way. And as long as I could hide that, I would be safe. So tearing the covers off or covering them up was all part of, you know, a very complex system I had as a kid to keep myself safe. And that system often failed. And, you know, it was like, just as you can imagine, why are you reading this? These are girl books. But they were the books I loved, and especially because they were books, and it was very painful to take off the covers because they were really, you know, a great draw to it. But I remember with the Silhouette First Love, they had a boy and a girl on it, and I rationalized to myself, well, if they have a boy on the cover, they must be also for boys.
What happened, like, when people would detect what you were reading? Like, did you have negative experiences with that?
I mean, yes, negative in that, like, they were not the appropriate books that boys read at that age. But, you know, I mean, even as an adult on the subway, and, you know, now we have a Kindle, so it's no longer an issue. I always think of that when I'm reading whatever it is I'm reading on my Kindle and think, gee, no one knows what this is in the ways that we used to hold books and advertise what we were reading. That we don't do that anymore. So I mostly read them in private, to be honest, once I sort of learned that they were not books to be read in public.
What did people, like, have to say when they caught you?
That it was a tell. Does that make sense? Like, it was a tell in the same way that my voice would be a tell, or in the same way that a certain article of clothing I liked would be a tell. And if I could control those tells better, I felt safer. So I don't think it was necessarily about the books as much as it was a boy reading a book with that cover is an object to be teased. I often hear you ask, like, how did you know you were gay? And I always think about that as, like, well, everybody was calling me a fag, so I just assumed I was. Like, it was not something I kind of figured out on my own. I was told that, and that sort of became how I figured it out.
What did that realization, like, look like for you? Like, was there a point where you were like, oh, they're not just calling me that, I actually am what they're saying?
Yeah, I think that happened really early on. Like, I knew I was gay and I knew I was attracted to men, but then there was this other category, which was a relationship and love and romance, and it took a really long time to kind of put those two things together that seemed very separate to me.
When did that put them together happen?
I mean, I guess by the time I got to college and started dating and started seeing that once I – you know, and I came out, but that's like, you know, it's not like the people around me were headless. Everybody knew I was gay. It wasn't just the romance books. I also liked things. In addition to stacking those books, I like to read Family Circle and Woman's Day. some of my favorite magazines. And I always had that part of me that was interested in things that were traditionally either gay or female. But I also had that part of me that always wanted to cover that part up. I always thought that was the part that was wrong.
You mentioned the tropes of the books, and with all the like pressure that you have coming from like outside to tell you like, oh, this is wrong and you shouldn't like this and we're going to make fun of you for it. It sounds like the tropes were a real source of comfort for you. So I'm curious about which, like, if there were particular ones that you were like, oh, this is really my jam. This is the stuff that I really love.
I definitely like enemies to lovers, which is a big trope in romance. And I definitely like opposites attract. And those were very comforting to me. But what's interesting as an adult now writing gay romance is that I'm trying to navigate the relationship between traditional romance tropes and what we call own voices and make sure that the tropes fit the identity, if that makes sense. And they don't always do that. And that's been a real struggle now as a writer for me of trying to figure out how to get those tropes to settle down and work for gay experiences.
Yeah. So what does that mean? Like, how is enemies to lovers or something like that? Like, is it just different when you're writing a gay relationship?
I think so. I mean, I think, and this might be personal for me, but one of my readers or my beta readers when I'm working on a draft commented that all of my characters want the same thing. They want to be safe. And I thought, yeah, well, of course. But that to me is such an important part of gay romance, like how we think of our relationships. We often need to feel safe in order to feel loved or give love or have love. And I don't think that is necessarily an important part of mainstream romance. So it's really about negotiating those two things and really making sure that, like, the characters are not just gay characters in straight romance, that they have their own obstacles and issues that are unique to being gay. And that's a struggle.
Yeah, that's really interesting that the romance itself is fundamentally different. I guess that kind of makes sense, although it surprised me that, like, heterosexual romances, like that safety wouldn't be a part of it. Like, that just seems kind of fundamental to me.
I think it is probably for some of the romances, but I don't know if it's quite as fundamental as it is for me in gay romance. So in the first gay romance of Karina Adores, this character really struggles with his masculinity. And I don't think that happens in mainstream romance in quite the same way. It's a character who was teased growing up and comes back to town. And this is a big romance trope, you know, returning to town, coming to the place they were raised. And he is a hyper masculine alpha guy. And he has put up this armor to protect himself and kind of comes back to town to show everybody he's not to be bullied or pushed around anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And he learns in that the very thing, like, that he's covering up is the reason this other character from his childhood actually loved him. And I think of that as like a very, and readers and gay men respond to this. They very much usually respond to this idea of, like, I thought I had to be this, but actually I need to be this.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I can see how that's just a different experience. Is that something that you draw on, like, personal experience? Like, is that something that, you know, you found in your own life when you're having romantic relationships and dating and stuff? Do you find yourself comparing real life to the books?
Well, I mean, the part of the book that is part of real life, and I think a lot of gay people experience this, which is, I don't know, do you have an alter persona that is more masculine or different than, like, your internal persona? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess, like, it depends on context, but
like, at Home Depot.
Oh, I don't know about there. I may have just given up on, like, that ship may have sailed for me.
No, but given up on, but you had one.
Yeah, that's probably true. At some point, I was probably trying to, you know,
pass.
Put it on at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is, you know, I think that becomes so... We don't even like sometimes. Actually, I was on the phone just the other day, and the plumber or somebody came to do work at our house. And I was on the phone with a friend, and I said something like, "Yeah, it's downstairs, you'll see the board," or whatever. And they were like, "Oh, that's your grease truck voice." And I was like, "Oh, yeah, sorry, I didn't realize I was using that." Like, I don't even think about it when I switch onto it. Like I call it my grease truck voice. I went to a college where there were trucks that sold food in front of the frats at night, and they would just ask point to people to get their orders, and you'd have to scream out in the crowd like cheeseburger with fries. And because it was in front of the frats, and I kind of felt unsafe there, whenever they pointed for my order, I would always say cheeseburger with fries or manicot or whatever, and that became my grease truck voice. And I always kind of slip between those two things. And actually, I was talking to my best friend growing up from childhood, who is Taiwanese, and she said, oh, and after 30 years of being friends, we talked about it. She said, yeah, you know, I've always had a voice I use that's my non-immigrant voice when I get on the phone and I want people to think of me as passing for this other thing. And there's a, and I, you're absolutely, like, I have shed that as a fully realized adult, but certainly growing up, that was really an important part of being able to pass, being able to protect myself in a place that was unknown to me. And growing up in Jersey suburbs, where it was kind of a lot of blue collar, hyper masculine places, that I felt protected me. Whether it did or not, I don't know. But I think that for gay men who feel like they can't pass, I developed this way of passing that kind of floated between the two, which is, you know, not great.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm familiar with that kind of code switching where, you know, who you present yourself as varies depending on the context.
Right. And I also to not disrupt things or not, you know, make things more difficult. So when you asked about dating, for me, I had thought that, like, I had to present my most masculine self in order to get a boyfriend.
Mm.
And I thought that's what you did, right? I mean, masculinity was the prize, I thought, growing up. I don't think that anymore. But I, like, masculinity was the prize because, I mean, I didn't have it. And it was something that was ephemeral and unattainable and seemed impossible to me, but I could get as close as I could to it. And that's what I thought I had to do. And in The Hideaway Inn, that's what that character thinks he has to do, of course. He thinks he has to be that thing in order to protect himself from the world, but really it's an armor that keeps the world away from you. And I really learned that. I am also a professor, and I've noticed over the years teaching the way my students who identify as queer don't have that pretense anymore.
Oh, wow.
They have walked in who they are in that way, and they don't have, for what I see from my perspective, that code switching. And there was a student last year who really was presenting without code switching, able to be who they were. And I remember them leaving and just sitting in my office and being really teary about it and thinking about, like, who would I be if I didn't spend my life doing that code switching? If I could fully be realized on just the other side of that equation, I don't even know from my generation. You know, I can't even imagine who that person is. Like, when I think of how I dress and how I act in public, like, I kind of, you know, gray is my favorite color. I dress in a very sort of neutral, you know, not very loud way, because that's what I did, you know, to stay, you know, safe in that way. And I wonder, what would it be like if I grew up not worrying about that, not trying to think that's what would save me?
Yeah. Well, so tell me about, like, when you were still figuring all that out. I knew you mentioned that, like, the voice that you'd put on and that you wore gray. What was, and you said that, like, masculinity was so ephemeral that it seemed like that was the prize. So was there a point where you realized that you don't have to do that so much, and maybe the damage is done from years of having, like, kind of internalized that? But, like, is that something that you kind of grew out of after a while?
I mean, I think I grew out of it as I was coming out, living in New York. So I went to graduate school in New York and was at NYU, which obviously is a very progressive liberal school, and there was not as much code switching there. I think the way that I really came out of it was when I was able to commodify it. And when I was in graduate school, I worked in commercials a lot. And I could be hyper masculine for like 30 seconds. And it was incredibly believable at that time. And I was like, oh, it's just this thing. It's not something that I have to it's not a prize. It's a commodity. And I kind of felt strong and sort of powerful and no longer needed it once I was able to understand it that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. You kind of appreciate it as a performance. So you're doing commercial acting.
Yeah, like the disgruntled dad or the confused mm-hmm. husband.
What brought you to that? Like, were you going to school for acting, or how did you?
No, I was in New York, and I had graduated, and I was dancing. I was dancing with a company, and I was going to graduate school, and I had found a friend of a friend through an agent who said, oh, you had, you know, that you might be good at doing this. So I went out and started going on commercial auditions, and I found it fascinating. And actually, then I wrote a series of books. I write also as a tween author, and I wrote a series of books called Commercial Breaks about tweens auditioning for commercials, because I found it so fascinating to know, like, I knew every guy who looked like me in New York at a certain point. I knew the guy who was a little older than me, a little younger than me, the guy who was like this, the guy who was like that. Like, you get to know you. I can't think of a way of getting to know who you are better than walking into a room for a commercial audition for your type.
Mm.
Because it's a room of 20 people, and they didn't say, send over 19 incredibly hot-looking guys, or 19 incredibly hot, incredibly chubby dads, and one incredibly hot guy. So if you're standing in a room with a bunch of 19 other guys, that's you. That's how the world sees you. And that, to me, was so interesting. And then to translate it to 13-year-old girls who were kind of figuring out who they were by comparing themselves to those rooms was how I kind of used that experience later. But I had been in lots of, you know, silly commercials for weird things.
So how did you get started writing?
That's an odd story. I wrote as a kid. And okay, so here we were asking about tells. When I was in eighth grade, I think, I won a national award for a short story. And the topic of the short story was a woman writing a letter to the supperware company because she was living in a suburb and she wanted a refund on her Tupperware because instead of having a Tupperware representative, a male stripper came for a strip party and knocked himself out in her kitchen somehow.
Okay.
And I was writing this as a 12-year-old boy about, like, a Tupperware party that goes wrong with male strippers. So that's – I know. It was – so I've always been interested in that part of writing. But then even though I was writing, I never identified myself as a writer in any way. Like, it just I always thought, well, what stories would I write? Like, I'm not going to write, you know, more traditional stories. And the role of Irma Bombeck had already been cast, so I wasn't sure where I fit in as a writer. And then I went to a religious, a mystic, shall we say, meeting. And
What? You went to what?
This takes a turn. So I went to a meeting with a friend who is a follower of an Eastern mystic. And it was a religious event for this group. And when this mystic left their body, they sang a song. And they said, now we are going to sing this song, a very important song about this mystic. And they sang the song, and I won't say it because it will identify the mystic, but it was a 40s pop ballad. And it gave me the giggles. And it was this very solemn moment, and I started getting those church giggles. And the woman next to me got these church giggles too. And we were laughing, so we were like, we could not control it. So we went outside of this very solemn meeting and just were hysterical together. And as it turned out, that woman was, I don't really talk about it, her in specific, but I will, was Olivia Goldsmith, who wrote The First Wives Club.
Oh, okay.
And we became friends, and I started ghosting with her before her death. So she, we were friends for a while, and she said, you know, I had a lot of student debt. I'd been in a couple of graduate programs. And one day she said, hey, why don't you think of an idea I can sell, and we'll pay your student loans off. And I said, oh, okay. And she went and she met with her architect, who we called Big Sally, and she came back and I had this idea, and I said, what do you think of this? And she said, great. And she called her agent, and that evening she had a deal memo.
So first of all,
sorry, sir. There's a lot in that story, isn't there?
Why was her architect called Big Sally, and why did she meet with her?
Oh, she was redoing her loft, and I called her Big Sally. I don't know why, but we
called her that. Okay. Sorry. I mean, that's like the least salient detail of the story. It's just such a it's vivid.
And so I started writing for her, and we wrote together. It's not like she was like, we were always partners in it. And then she died very famously during plastic surgery. And I thought I was going to become Olivia Goldsmith. I thought that was my career for my life. And it was devastating. We were, of course, close friends. It was, of course, complicated because of the relationship, but I really didn't know what I would do. And so I wrote our, the books and movies and things we were pitching. I started writing them on my own. Well, it was a time of chick lit, and chick lit doesn't want, I went to auction with these books, and then they found out I was a guy. And it was just a moment in time where that was just not what they wanted. And I thought, crap, what am I going to do? And I had an agent at the time, and she was like, well, what about tween books? And I thought, oh, I hadn't really thought of it. And so I took all of our ideas, and I just rewrote them as tween books, and I started writing for tweens as a 13-year-old girl. I mean, not as a 13-year-old girl. I wrote them as an adult, but they all had 13-year-old first-person female characters. And so I wrote those, and it would be very odd because we'd go to schools, and I remember Jenny Hahn and Taylor Morris and I were doing a school event, and we go in and they take all the boys and put them in a different room to play basketball, and we do an assembly to just the girls, and there's me on stage, and I'm like, once again, it's like I'm not in the right room here. It was just very – and I thought about the boy who's forced to play basketball with these boys, who he's probably terrified of, who maybe wants to read the books of these female authors and me who are there. So I decided – and I was writing as a 13-year-old girl, which was fine, and I feel obviously very comfortable in that. And then I started returning to romance because I'd read romance growing up. But then for me, what happened, there were no gay romances. Everything at my time period turned towards AIDS. So books started being not romantic, but very frightening to me. And so I went back to reading mainstream romance. And then more recently, reading gay romance, I decided to do that. And of course, now I'm finding that while there are gay male readers, and I'm hoping there will be more, 95% of the books are read by women and written by women. So I've gone from writing tween books as a boy for girls, then finding my own voice as a gay man, and now I'm in another sort of weird, you know, through the looking glass.
Yeah, gosh. But I mean, it does sound like you can right now with this line that's just launched, you are writing, you know, they say like write what you know, like you're actually writing about your community.
Right. But remember, I'm writing about my community for women. And while there are certainly gay men, and I hope who will read this, and I hope more, but that's really the sort of, you know, strangeness of it for me.
Does that change, like that audience change how you are writing?
It doesn't change how I'm writing. It changes how they receive my books. Like I write the story that I want to write. But like, so for this character in The Hideaway Inn, he is a real difficult guy. And the gay men who write to me about this guy often say like, oh yeah, I get it. He comes back and he's pissed because he was so teased as a kid. And I think, I'm not sure if female readers always understand the kind of wound that makes for a gay kid when they return, like how you hold that chip on your shoulder, and whether you act like that or not, the fantasy you have, like, don't you have this fantasy if anyone was ever teased you of like, you know, being able to tell them off?
Sure. Yeah.
And like, wasn't there, there was a moment in Facebook when people were like finding me from high school.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had this, and they would be like, oh, hey, I remember you from high school. You were so funny, or you were this. And I was so awful. I would write them back and say, oh, yeah, I remember you. You put me in a locker, took Love's Baby Soft from Jenny, sprayed me in Love's Baby Soft, and said, hey, you act like a girl, now you smell like one. So how are you doing? I'd kind of remember what each person had done to me, and I did like a very sort of horror movie response, but then I was very friendly afterwards.
Well, I guess, yeah, that, I guess once you get that out of your system, you don't need to hold on to it anymore.
Well, it's also this idea of like, I think there were, like, I often told the story in a funny way of like, here's what I remember. But like those things happened. And I wanted to remember that, like, how that experience sort of shaped who I am. And maybe I'm just, as my students might say, maybe I'm just mean. But I also thought that, you know, this is the real experience of it and the wholeness of it.
So how do people respond when they find out the kind of writing that you do? I think there's sort of a cultural idea around like romance novels as being a distinct form of literature. So I'm curious about like how you navigate people's opinions about your work.
Well, since writing these books, I've become a romance advocate. Like, I hope gay men will return to romance and really think about that as a way of, you know, enjoying those stories. And I know, and it's like, I know we are speaking different languages because I know there are, like, this is not, like, you know, when people come out and say, like, oh, I read comic books and I was a nerd, there is definitely a coolness factor to that. Don't you think so at this point?
Yeah,
absolutely.
That wasn't there before.
Yeah, that wasn't there before, but it's like you can say that now and be cool. I don't think that's true about romance, do you?
Probably not at this moment, no.
Probably not. So there is this like stigma attached to it, or this like, and I think it's because we never had those stories growing up. I don't think there were, like, I can't think of a gay romance story that I saw or heard of as a kid. There were these old, Derek, I can't remember his name, Derek Martin. There were these kind of pulp gay romances from the 70s that came out, but there weren't those stories. And I hope that, like, I think I really love reading romances, and I hope there are other gay men who will want to. I think we got stuck when we have lots of highbrow gay literature. We have lots of gay literature, but we don't have a lot of gay commercial fiction. And I think it's important. I think commercial fiction is an important part of any subgenre. And I think seeing yourself in commercial fiction is really important. And I hope that people will engage with it, and young gay people and older gay people return to it, because I think it's really missing in gay culture. I can't think of commercial fiction that we have.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you know this much, the market much better than I do, but, you know, I'm just trying to think of, in the same way that we have, like, rom-coms, I guess there's sort of, like, a very small subgenre of rom-com, like, movies for, that have gay storylines, but they tend not to be great, and pretty few in number.
Right, and I think they're very small, and I might agree with you that they tend not to be great. And I wonder if that issue is this fitting into the mold of what is traditional mainstream rom-com and what is gay rom-com. And they're different things. And we do see more of them. I mean, there is so much more with a boyfriend material and Red, White, and Royal Blue, which you may have heard of. You know, those books are becoming, like, Red, White, and Royal Blue is hugely popular. It's a gay romance about the son of an American president and the son of the queen in England or something like this. There are these gay male stories coming out, not many of them written by gay men, but I think as they begin to do that, those tropes in that genre, like rom-coms, have the potential to change. I think it's when we're trying to fit them into the mainstream structures. I don't know if they work so much.
So tell me about of your own work, like the books that you're particularly proud of.
So the books that I love my tween books because they are, I think, challenging notions of what tween books are. That's probably heady for me to say, but they have gay characters in them that I had to code very specifically. And at the time was told, you know, I had to really change things. Like, you won't get into the Scholastic Book Fair. This is really only like 6 or 7 years ago. You won't get into Scholastic Book Fairs if you have gay parents in your books. And changing the characters so that there's a character whose name is Tommy, but he goes by the name Dixie in the one of the series. And I'm really proud of that character because he goes by Dixie because he said the boys call him Miss Dixieland because he's from Alabama when he went through the lunchroom. But he liked the name Dixie, so he decided to keep it. And I'm really proud of those pieces in it. And I'm really excited about these romances because I think they address gay issues in ways that are super important. And I think they address the ways in which gay people struggle to connect with each other. And so in this next book that's coming out in January, one of the characters is a 19th century antiques appraiser.
Okay.
And I think this is not so, and Susan Sontag actually writes about this in a much better way, but one is a 19th century antiques appraiser and the other collects Scooby-Doo mugs and comic books and Star Wars paraphernalia, and they have to share an antique shop, and you can imagine the hilarity that ensues there. So there's a 19th century antiques appraiser, and I was interested in the way in which gay men use expertise in order to create importance and, again, feel safe. And do you think like that idea of being safe is a unique gay issue or universal or not necessarily gay at all?
Well, I don't know. There may be a particular priority for gay men. I think that safety, like, I think that just seems like a universal human need, but I think depending on the context in which you grew up, it's probably something that you sort of learn. You have to be very deliberate about seeking out.
Yeah. So in this, the 19th century antiques collector is an expert in all things from this period. And I've met so many gay men and friends who develop a geek nerd-like expertise in a single arcane area. And it's this way, that happens across the board. I don't see it as common in other cultures and genres, But with gay men, I see it used as like, here's a place where I have expertise, and here's a place where I am my own person, and I have control, and I am safe over these details about this thing. And I think Susan Sontag writes about it in terms of the ballet and Susan Farrell, and like how gay men became aficionados of this very elite and specific culture. And that's, and I, so I think that is something that I'm proud of bringing to romance, because I think it's something that I hope speaks to some experience of being gay.
Yeah. So tell me about the books that you're working on now. Like, do you have like a, either something in the works that you're excited for, or like a dream project that you want to get started on?
So The Seasons of New Hope is the series that I'm working on, and romance often comes out in a series that goes from a summer romance to a winter romance. And the summer romance takes place in New Hope, Pennsylvania, which is about 10 miles from where I'm sitting right now. And New Hope is one of those Fire Island, Provincetown, Rehoboth Beach, gay resort vacation towns that are, that have been known. And I always knew about New Hope growing up, and I always wanted to write a story that took place in a gay town. I guess this goes back to, like, you know, I feel safe in a gay town, so it goes back to that idea. And the first book is about a guy who opens an inn and has to reconcile his relationship with the farm boy who broke his heart. And the second one, as I mentioned, is about two opposites, a 19th century antiques appraiser and a collector of TV memorabilia, like Muppet stuff and comic books and Star Wars, and about how they come together. They're very scenic. They're very emotional. There is a lot of relationship talk in it, but they're really also lighthearted, fun, romantic books.
That sounds really sweet. It's a kind of like just very pleasant romance with it sounds like a happily ever after that a lot of gay stories like are just, you know, the drama and the heartbreak and all that stuff, you know, and the seriousness of gay life and the struggle of being gay doesn't always get to. So it's nice to have something that's just like it's just lovely. There's just something that's lovely.
Well, exactly. And, you know, this is what I find as a reader missing from the landscape of literature that I read. And so when I started, so I read romances, and then in the 80s, I don't know if you remember the series of vintage contemporaries that came out, like Mona Simpson was there, and Bret Easton Ellis, those books came out in the 80s. So like I went from reading light YA to reading contemporary fiction. And like Bret Easton Ellis, I mean, those, like to go from Sweet Valley High to Bret Easton Ellis.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's quite a shock. And where is the step in between? There wasn't one. And to go from stories about characters like finding themselves and going to dances to being in hospital rooms and dealing with death was quite, you know, shocking. There were no happy endings for gay characters. They were either, you know, if it was a gay romance, a gay relationship book in the 90s, one of the characters died. That was just, that was all there is. So I stopped reading those because for that type of outlet that I wanted of recreational fiction, that didn't do it for me. So, and I think, and lots of gay men left that and really, I think, you know, were, while they read those books, and they didn't give them the fix for commercial fiction or fiction that helps you escape. And that's what I think these books now do, to give gay men happy, and not happy endings, although they could get those, I guess, on their own. We call it Happily Ever After is the HEA. And that's an important, but see, that's an important part of romance and why these genres sort of are at odds with each other. You cannot write a romance without a happily ever after. It will be destroyed by the romance community and considered not a romance. You can write a love story like that, but you cannot market something or put it in the genre of romance. They are, like all genre fields, very, very strict. And so we are now finding, I think, those happily ever afters.
Well, that's great. And so if people want to find those and check out your books, and or if you have recommendations for further reading, where should people look?
Well, I only use Twitter to feel bad about myself and bad about others. But I'm on Instagram as Philip William Stover, and all of my books and all of my things are there.
Fantastic. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Philip for joining me. For this week's recommendation, check out one of my favorite gay love stories, the 1986 film My Beautiful Laundrette. I hesitate to call it a story exactly, because it's more of a slice-of-life study of two London outsiders. One is a young man from an immigrant family who's been tasked with running a laundromat, the other's a disaffected young man wrapped up in racist street violence, and they're both unsure about their futures, but they can't deny their feelings for each other. That might sound like a somewhat formulaic rom-com premise, but the movie is infused with a quiet thoughtfulness and a vulnerability that never stops being surprising. Add to that some moments of particularly daring sexiness, and you've got a film that will linger with you long after you've watched. Thanks again for listening, and thanks to everyone who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get some backer rewards. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode on Twitter and Facebook. Reach out and let me know your thoughts on the show at sewerspodcast@gmail.com. And join us for the next live stream on September 19th at 11 a.m. Pacific. There's a link pinned to the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Check out my YouTube series Culture Cruise for detailed explorations of queer milestones from TV and film. Just search YouTube for Culture Cruise. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.